Hi, everyone. So this is part two of our final episode of season one. If you haven't listened to part one yet, you should go listen to that first. After this episode, we'll be working on some exciting new things for season two. So make sure you follow us on your favorite podcast platform because we'll be rolling out new episodes soon. We hope you've enjoyed season one of Novels with Nightcaps. And now on with the show.
What?
I said I'm feeling pretty tipsy.
Oh, I've drank this entire bottle of wine by myself. So the fact that I'm still coherent should say a lot.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I have like one glass left, I think, so I might as well.
I just finished I guess I have like one little sip left of this coffee cocktail and then some of my wine left.
I feel like it just makes our podcast better.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Just slowly going off the rails.
It's fine. I don't remember what books we're going to talk about next.
Did you almost say Outlander or Outlawed?
Outlawed.
We're going to talk more about Outlander.
Even though neither of us have read it, it's fine.
Yeah.
She carries and – or what we carry and
– yeah, Outlawed and what we carry. And that's it.
Okay.
Yay.
I just need to be able to bring up my notes so I can
– oh, yeah. All right. That was a solid clap.
It was. You did great.
Whew. All right. And we're back with Women's History Month, which was March last month. So our March book club pick was What We Carry by Maya Schombach Lang, who grew up idolizing her mother, who was an accomplished physician who immigrated to the United States from India and completed her residency all while raising her children and keeping a traditional Indian home. She had always been a source of support until Maya became a mother herself. Then the parent who had once been so capable and attentive turned unavailable and distant. Struggling to understand this abrupt change while raising her own young child, Maya searches for answers and soon learns that her mother is living with Alzheimer's. When Maya steps in to care for her, she comes to realize that despite their closeness, she never really knew her mother. What We Carry is the story of a daughter and her mother, of lies and truths, of receiving and giving care, and how we cannot grow up until we fully understand the people who raised us. So this is a timely, solid choice for Mother's Day, even though it's
not May yet.
Kind of sad and, well, yeah, Mother's Day coming up. But, yeah, it was a bit of a somber read, which
it was,
I guess, both of our book club picks this month, January and February, were kind of somber.
Yeah. I didn't think about it that way, but yes.
Yeah. We went from The Color Purple to What We Carry, which, I mean, they're both – they have uplifting and sad aspects. It's not, like, super depressing. I feel like when people are like, oh, the reads are so depressing, I'm like, well, you know, it's – multi-dimensional.
It's a heartwarming, like, ending or point to the story is heartwarming.
Right.
So,
yeah, I think it just depending on, like, where you're at in life, like, it might hit close to home. Because, I mean, obviously, it's going to be very relatable to anyone who's cared for an aging parent or watched a parent care for their aging parent. There's a lot of, like, messy and complicated emotions that come to the surface toward the end of life. And I think it's a difficult, you know, topic that not a lot of people want to talk about. And I know during book club, we discussed this, and I don't know if this was like a quote from the book directly, or if we just kind of brought it up, the fact that like, there's all these handbooks on like how to have children and raise children, but there's no real guidebooks to like death and how to care for family members who are dying. And
Yeah, end of life care is like just and we all thrust upon you, and you don't. Yeah, it's and
even more so than like having kids. Like this is like, I mean, having kids is a choice. Like we don't get a choice in dying. Like
no, yeah, like your parents are your parents, and they are going to be old and pass away, and that's gonna happen regardless of where you are in life. And we talked specifically about like. A lot of us had, like, personal experience to some degree. Like, your mom talked about, which I love that your mom is part of a book club. But we love Susie. Yeah. But I thought, like, her feelings, like, her experience with dealing with both of her parents were, that was, it related to this book a lot. Like,
yeah. Yeah. And I think, like, that kind of that secondhand experience that I had from like being like emotional support, I guess. I hope I was. I tried the best that I could to like support her emotionally while she was having to go through that. And that's difficult in itself. So it's like an interesting challenge that kind of affects like everyone in a different way. Like we all experience like the different levels of it, from like being like the grandchild to being the child of the parent who's going through that. So yeah, it was there were a lot of things, like although my grandpa like didn't have Alzheimer's, like there were a lot of like things that were relatable in this book, like when she gets into talking about like her mother kind of choosing to it's like she talks about it as like entering this new stage of life, which her mother is like becoming a different person because
she has to mourn her twice. She has to mourn her twice.
Right. She's she's like mourning the loss of like her mother as she knew her, right? Because she's developing Alzheimer's and becoming like a different person. But I think even beyond like the Alzheimer's aspect and dementia, I think that in general, you see your parents like in a different light when they get older, regardless of if they go through those things, because you are having to kind of like see them as just a person instead of just seeing them as a parent. And I think that's very hard for people, and it kind of sheds a light on, like, the selfishness of, you know, being someone's child. Like, the expectations that you place on mothers in particular, I think, more so than fathers, but which I think goes into play here in, like, this book, like, kind of what she expected from her mother, like, the certain level of, like, maternal care.
Right.
And when it isn't there, and when your mother is the one that's in need – it really affects you and hits you in this way that it's like, oh, my mom is just a person. Like, she's not just my mom. Like, she's a human with like
she's her whole self,
right?
Aside from me, you know.
Yeah.
Well, that's like with my mom. My mom recently, we talked about this in book club. My mom recently retired early so that she could care for her parents, and we're very lucky that. My grandfather and my grandmother are both like mentally with it, which is something that this author deals with, the dementia and the Alzheimer's or whatever it ends up being in the end. But but physically it is very difficult to take care of my grandfather because he is paralyzed from the waist down and has been since he was in his 50s, I think, or maybe even a little earlier. I'm terrible with timelines, so I don't know. You know, it's dealing with all that and like the care at home stuff because it's becoming more difficult for him to take care of himself because he has these limitations with being a paraplegic. Is a paraplegic when you're quadriplegic when you're all four para?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's my whole life he's been paralyzed and I'm like, is it paraplegic? I don't know. But so she's taking care of him and he's diabetic and he has some other things, but they're like mentally they're pretty with it, my grandparents, and but she's retired to take care of them, and it's very hard on her. Mm-hmm. And she has three siblings, and one lives away, and two are boys. And so she has two brothers, and the two brothers are like, they'll show up and do stuff like when they're told to show up and do stuff, but it's very different than just being like constantly the person responsible for taking care of your elderly parents. And so in the book, she talks about how when her mom starts to show this like dementia thing and they need to take care of her, she says, "You're going to come home with me. You're going to live with me. I'm going to take care of you." And my mom kind of did the same thing. It was just her and my dad decided mm-hmm. we're going to take care of them. We live near them. We're going to be the ones that take care of them. And it's not like she asked her siblings for permission to do that, or they didn't really have input. And it's the same with the brother in this book, where he wants to help, but he lives away. And he's like, you have to tell me what to do, because she's not living with me. I don't have those same things. But it's very difficult, and there's no guidebook for how to do it and how to do it well. And it did ultimately, my mom experiencing this, she was like, okay, so your dad and I are going to go into assisted living, because I'm not going to put the same burden on the three of you, where one of you has to decide. And I fully know it'd be my sister.
Yeah.
1,000% my sister would be the one who has to take care of my parents, because my brother lives in the same vicinity, but he's a brother. And for whatever reason, men don't have the same and that's an evolutionary thing.
Yeah.
It's like I forget what it's called, you would know as the anthropologist, but that like grandmother.
Yeah, the grandmother. Well, that's like a whole theory that like women die when they're no longer taking care of someone.
Right. And they care more about their like offspring being.
Yeah. And I think it's also like gender norms too, though, like just a societal thing that like men in general feel like that isn't their job. Like that's not their place to like be the caretaker. And so I think in like a lot of like sibling relationships, unless like there's a big age gap, like with mine, like my brother's 12 years older than me, so that could be different because of that. I feel like if you're closer in age, it tends to like fall on the woman.
Yeah. And my sister is this like fucking phenom of caretaker type person, like where that's just, I mean, she helps my mom a lot right now with my grandparents. Like my grandfather, when he needs like insulin shots or he needs whatever, like my sister is like, yeah, it just shows up and does that. Whereas I would be like, I have to give him a shot. I don't know if I can do that. Like, I would just panic and be like, I don't know. Let's get a nurse in here to do this. But my sister is like this brilliant, like, I don't know. She's brilliant and she's like a caretaker type. So it just fits her that she would be the one that like takes care of my parents. And I would be, and I live away, and that's a different dynamic as well. And I feel like I would hope that I would be like, hey, just tell me when I come to visit, just tell me what I need to do. And I will do those things. And I will make sure that I am helpful in whatever way I can be as the away person. But yeah, so if my sister listens to this, which I'm not sure she does, but if she does, just know, we know that you're the one. But the feeling in this book is like, she is very successful and she has a child of her own, but she decides, like, she has that kind of like feeling where she's like, I need to be the one who takes care of my mother when she's this, you know.
Yeah.
And I have a very brilliant mother and a very successful mother. And I am enamored of my mother. And so like I love her and I think she's great. And so I kind of felt a kinship with her, the idea that, because I go to my mom with a lot of things because I'm like, well, she's really smart and she's really
assertive.
Decisive. Yeah, she's assertive and she's decisive.
Like the mom in this book, I think that played a big part, is that like she was always relying on her mom to like stand up for her.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like I have that same relationship. So I was like, I feel that, where you're losing that mother. But then I wanted to take notes to remind myself to be like, just let my mom enjoy the flowers. Like, don't, because she gets so pissed off at her mom because her mom is not the brilliant woman she used to be. Yeah. And so she gets viscerally like angry at her mother for just being like, oh, the garden looks beautiful today. I'm like, just fucking let her enjoy the flowers. Like, it made me so upset. I was right. so upset. I was like, just let her. She's already lost herself. She's finding a new self with Alzheimer's and dementia.
Yeah.
And she wants to let her enjoy the little things. And so I like made a note where I was like, okay, so if my mom gets dementia, I just need to be like, it's fine that you're no longer brilliant and assertive and decisive. I'm just going to let you enjoy the flowers.
Yeah.
You know, but this book is very much like a guide. I appreciate that she wrote it because mm-hmm. it's very much a guide of like how you would take care of your parent when it's this kind of situation.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like as a society, like we don't put enough like emphasis and we don't talk enough about like the stages of life. And so I think that that does make it like really challenging because we kind of expect people to be the same person that they are like throughout their entire life. And that's just not the reality of, you know, humanity.
Aging.
Not,
yeah.
And aging, like being like mortal. That's not, it's not the reality of it. So I think, you know, it would be nice if we like, actually like educated people more on these topics or even just like discuss them more like in an open way instead of being afraid to talk about them because it is like a morbid conversation. Like nobody wants to talk about death, obviously.
Right.
But it's just, you know, it's the reality. And you know, I think seeing your parents, like even if they're not close to that point in their life, I think even like at our age, like we've seen our parents go through different phases of life and they're not like necessarily the same person. And, you know, like, I mean, in my case, like my, you know, parents were divorced like when I, you know, graduated high school. And so I think that in itself like becomes like your parents become like they took on like different identities because they were no longer together. And like having been like high school sweethearts, like they kind of shared one identity. And then like I saw them as like two separate people. So that in itself was like a change. And I just, mm-hmm. you know, expect those changes to like keep occurring, like even if they're uncomfortable. So
you're probably better set up, honestly, to deal with it.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
That's put pressure on you to be like, you're going to be great at it. Do it right. But I do think that because like my parents were high school sweethearts and they're still together. And mm-hmm. I'm very lucky in that regard that I don't. You know,
yeah,
but they were like anomaly. 17 and 22. Yeah, they were 17 and 22 or whatever when they got married and they're still like going strong, which I think has a lot to do with their particular personalities. But that's a different story for a different time. But, yeah. And I am lucky that they're still together because I do think that ultimately it'll be easier for us as children because I think our parents will take care of each other for so long in the same way yeah. that my grandparents are like. My grandmother, God bless her, she's the meanest lady on the planet, but she loves my grandfather and she takes care of him every single day.
I hope she's listening.
I do too. Yeah. You're the meanest. She is. She's the meanest nice lady that's ever existed. But she'll do anything for him, but she's grumpy about it. Like
yeah.
that's, you know, that's yeah. her personality.
We were just, it's funny you say that because we were just talking yesterday. My mom was actually in town visiting and we were at a winery yesterday. So, you know, we were a couple glasses in, all loosened up.
And like this whole bottle that I've yeah. had while we've been talking. Yeah.
Yeah. We were in our second bottle and we were like, talking about this same kind of thing, like we were talking about like women who take on these roles as like caretakers. And we were talking about like Roderick's family, like it's again, like I think it's a common thing, like the women in his family. And I don't think it's like, you know, just his family. I think families in general, like the women like take on these like maternal roles, even if they don't have children, of like taking care of other women. And it's funny because a lot of times it's like in this like resentful way. It's like yeah. it's like they feel obligated to do it. And yeah. it kind of in a way like and this is not to like sound like sexist like at all, but like it almost is like this purpose driven, like this is something that like I'm meant to do. I'm meant to take care of someone or people, or like, or maybe it's almost like an ego, like they can do it better. They think like, You know, I don't know the full psychology.
The author of this book, though, that's very in line with her. With her. I think that's very in line, where she was like, I'm the daughter, so I need to do these things. And then she has the resentful kind of feelings about her career and whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like, it's a lot of women that I know, like, they're the first person to, like, volunteer themselves to step up and take care of someone, but they're going to complain about it all fucking day long.
I'm going to be mad about it.
You better believe it. Yeah, it's like, I'm going to be pissed about this, and I'm also going to rub it in your face, like, every chance I get, but I'm still going to do it. And yeah, it's like, I feel like there's probably so many, like, things that go into why certain women, you know, do that and feel that way. But yeah, I think that, again, it goes back to, like, these gender norms, like, what we expect from, like, women as mothers, like, versus, like, men as fathers, and not holding men to, like, the same standards.
Absolutely.
I think that, you know, even in aging, like, with, you know, seeing my – I was a lot younger, like, when my grandmother passed away versus when my grandfather passed away, which was just last year. I mean, he was in his 90s. So, it was different in that, like, his was, like, a very, like, drawn out process. Like, he was in, like, good health and everything, and went into, like, a nursing home where my grandmother did not, like, none of that ever happened. Yeah. Like, it was just, like, more, like, sudden. But I think in general, it seemed like people were, you know, a little, like, more accepting and, like, understanding, I guess, of, like, men going through that stage of life, because we attribute those sort of, like, characteristics to men in general, like, the whole, like, being independent and pride, mm-hmm. and, like, all of these, like, kind of masculine characteristics, we assign them to, like, men, and we're like, oh, well, you know, like, that's normal. Like, he is an older man of, like, a certain generation, and of course he, like, wants his independence, and he wants to go do his own thing and doesn't want to be taken care of, and, you know, all of those things. Like, it's more kind of like we can wrap our brains around it, whereas with women during the process, I think it's more complicated because we don't know how to feel about it, and we feel a lot of guilt around it, I think, too. This feeling of, like the author, like, she's like, I think, you know, that's a lot of people's, like, first instinct is, like, I'm going to just be the caretaker, not fully realizing, like, what all that entails.
Right. So, like, Pat, my husband's grandmother was in an assisted living because she had Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. She was in assisted living. And I remember her – I never met her until we were married. And then I went to visit her at her assisted living place. And they asked her, do you know who this is? And it was me and Patrick. And she was like, yeah, they're from that picture that's by my TV. Like, she didn't know who we were. Right. She knew that she had a picture of us. And that's how, you know, that was. But she was this very caring, very sweet. Like, she was the type of person that if you wanted to clone people to make sure that everybody in future generations was kind and loving of every single person they encountered, that was her.
Yeah.
Adeline Victoria. Just the best lady in the world. A tiny little beautiful human. And so she had Alzheimer's, and dealing with it was her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And her daughter did make the decision, and, like, with her brothers, you know, to put her in an assisted living because that was where she could get the best care.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like poor Irma was like, is that, you know, is that the best choice? And I don't know. There was, like, it felt like there was a lot of pressure on Irma herself, and then also on mm-hmm. Patrick's grandmother, because it was like they were such caring, giving, loving people that it's like we have this expectation that they should continue to be that to all people forever, even when they are needing assistance or needing help. They were forever the caretakers, and so then they should just continue to be that.
Yeah.
Even when it's no longer possible for them to be that.
Right.
And of course, I don't know. It's so hilarious and beautiful in his family, because his grandmother was like this nobody has a negative thought about her. I don't know how she existed in the world because I'm like, she's so sweet and loved everyone she ever met, and mm-hmm. nobody had a negative thought about her. But it is hard to have this mother who is so accepting and so beautiful and so wonderful, which is what this author kind of describes her mother as being. Mm-hmm. And here's this perfect example of motherhood. And when they start to lose their memory or start to lose their understanding of reality. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, well, what do I do now? Because that has been the person in my life that has always been solid and the one, you know, right. But we don't put that same kind of pressure on fathers. Like,
yeah,
you know, when they go to nursing homes or they go wherever, you're just like, I love grandpa and I'm going to go see him today. Like,
yeah,
but you don't have that same feeling of expectation of that. That's a person that should be taking care of me.
Right.
You know, and there's no handbook for that exchange of power where you go from being the one who's taken care of by your parents and your grandparents and whoever else in your life, which I'm lucky because the people in my life are still like mentally with it. So they're still taking care of me. I'm too old to be relying on them to take care of me, but it's fine. I don't have kids of my own yet. So I'm still living in this world where I'm like, I'm fine. I'm the kid. It's whatever. But there's no handbook for that exchange of power. And I think that's the same like struggle that this author went through. Was like her mother was that very like everyone had this inflated sense of like importance. She was this wonderful, brilliant human mm-hmm. who did all these things for all these other people. And there wasn't a rule book for when that changed from her just being like, the garden is beautiful.
Right.
And you're her daughter having to take on that same, that level of care mm-hmm. That she was expecting. And so it's, yeah, I guess the whole point, like in our whole book club, everything we talked about was just like, this book was, it needed to be written because we need more handbooks on how to deal with aging at home and aging in general and how you deal with going from being the one that your parent takes care of to being the one that takes care of your parent.
Right.
So yeah, so it's a good read for anybody who eventually will be responsible for taking care of their parent.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there were a couple lines from this book that I wrote down that stood out. One of the quotes was, maybe at our most maternal, we aren't mothers at all. We're daughters reaching back in time for the mothers we wish we had and then finding ourselves. And The other line was, until we are in the river, which I guess I should preface this by saying there's a story that her mother like continuously tells throughout the book. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a which it starts off as what they think is Indian folklore. And then by the end of it is kind of unclear. Like it sounds like it might be like a family story that was passed down.
I can't.
Yeah, so it was, until we are in the river up to our shoulders, until we are in that position ourselves, we cannot know the answer. We tell ourselves we will sacrifice ourselves for our children, but the will to live is very strong. And this is in regards to a story, like I said, her mother tells about this woman being in the river and her holding her child like above her head, trying to save the child from drowning. And she would always kind of end this story as like, it was like open-ended, which is common in like folklore. So it's like leaving like the ending, like up to the listener's interpretation. And her daughter, so the daughter, the author, she asked her mother, like when she's in the nursing home, she brings up the story again. And her mother kind of reveals like the opposite of what the author had expected the outcome of the scenario to be, which was, you know, she of course had always thought mother would always sacrifice herself for her child. And her, basically the story that her mother was trying to tell was that we can't judge because until you're in that position, you have no idea what you would actually do, which that was interesting. Like her mother was a psychiatrist. So, I mean, it's actually very like realistic, even though it's a kind of, you know, gruesome thing to think about. I mean, she's correct in like this whole, you know, the idea of like the will to live is very strong. It's hard to know like what you would do as a human, like in a situation like that. And yeah. I think And she also was saying, like, just because, like, that could have happened didn't mean, like, they didn't both survive in that situation.
Yeah, there's the whole parable is the word I want to use, but I don't actually know if that's correct. I'm too drunk to know if that's the right word. But I think it's where you just come out with your own decision on it. But throughout the, like, the author, when she's bringing up that story and she's, you know, we're all supposed to be taking away whatever. It is like this expectation of mothers that we're supposed to be so selfless when it comes to our own children that, well, and that our innate, like the things that are built into being a human, we somehow like set aside.
Right.
And I don't know if that's actually true. I would like to think it's true. I would love to think that I'm that person and that when it comes to my godchildren or my nieces and nephews, my nibblings, I would love to think that I would be like them at all costs, but would
I? Right.
And, yeah.
And I think also like the lesson there too, though, is like, it's not just like this kind of the truth hurt sort of a thing where it's like, well, this is just, you know, human instinct, like the human instinct takes over and you, the will to live takes over and you would just save yourself. Like it's, it's basically this, I think like the story is also showing that by saving herself, like it's also pushing this sort of like independence, like on the child. So I think it was supposed to, like kind of be this, like it's a parallel to like what they're dealing with where her mother is, you know, coming to the end of her life. And so she is, so the author's having to take on this different role where she's having to finally like be the caretaker and also, you know, take care of herself versus expecting her mother to do it for her. And that's kind of like the analogy, I guess, with like the story of the woman in the river. Like, even though she lets go of her son, like she's like, well, what's to her child? It's her mother's basically like, who's to say like the child doesn't live? Like, I never said that, you know, just because she let go of the child doesn't mean the child didn't live, sort of a thing.
Yeah. And I hate to bring this to like a Christian religious thing because gross. But I think of Moses in the basket and she puts him in the river.
Yeah.
The thing. It's that same kind of thing, like depending on what I don't know, what religion you grew up in or what culture you grew up in, you have a similar story. But like there's no there's nothing saying that that you didn't do the best thing for both.
Exactly. For both. Yeah.
And but we take it because we put so much pressure on women. We assume that in a story like that, there can't be a positive ending for both people unless the mother sacrifices herself, which is an unrealistic and totally unfair amount of pressure to put on women that like it can't possibly be that both come out all right in the end. Like unless you sacrifice yourself, it's a sad ending. And I think that was kind of the mom. And I did like I remember talking about in book club there was this part about how she's pregnant, the author is pregnant. The author's gonna have her child. And she is overwhelmed and she's upset and she doesn't think – she thinks that she's like somehow not being a good enough mom because what she remembers is that her mom was like perfect. But then she finds out that her mom sent her brother away for like years to India. Like she just sent him away. She was like, this is too stressful, away. Like and there's no – there's no judgment there. There shouldn't be any judgment because she's like trying to do the best thing for everybody in the moment. But but the daughter is like, I didn't know that and no one would tell me that. Right. So now I think I'm this like less than parent when ultimately we are both good parents because we did what was best for the child in the moment or whatever was happening at the time. I just think this is a great thing to read and to understand because as a 30-something year old, my parents are very young for my age. And so I'm lucky in that regard that they are sprightly and lovely and they're doing their own thing. But it is nice to know what to expect and for someone to be honest about what it feels like to help your parent age at home. Mm-hmm. And to not have, and then again, you and I, of course, as the ones in book club to do this, we're like, yeah, well, the United fucking States, if we would just have money to make sure that we could take care of the elderly, we wouldn't even have these issues. Like,
yep.
That should be something that's built into our society to take care of people when they age. And then it wouldn't be as much pressure on children. And of course, I have the whole idea, like, as a person who wants to have children, but also thinks about the world as it is today, I'm like, first of all, kids never asked to be born. So yeah. Should I expect my child to take care of me? Especially because by the time I have a child, I'm going to be old as fuck. Like that's,
yeah.
So my poor child is probably going to be like 18 years old and having to deal with my aging self. But it's that thing where it's like, they didn't ask to be born. So should I ask them to take care of me? Mm-hmm. And this was another thing that I felt like she kind of addressed a little bit in the book, is like, she has a good relationship with her mom. So she wants to take care of her mom, you know, and ultimately in the end, and I'm like, I hope I just have enough money for someone to come in and take care of me. So my kid can just be like, let's hang out today, mom. But they don't have to actually like worry about who's giving my medication and
yeah.
and helping me, like, I don't know, move every day. So,
yeah.
You know,
I just think of that. I think it was on Netflix. I don't think you watched it because you were like, I don't have any interest in watching that, but I care a lot.
Because me and your husband are the same person and we're yeah. like, no, that's sad and I don't want to deal with it.
A yeah. woman who like preys on older people who don't have family, living relatives that they know of. I feel like that's like a valid concern. You're like, oh, if I yeah. don't have kids, like, I'm just going to have a big ass target on my head for people just taking advantage of me. Who is going to
take care of me in the end?
Yeah. It's like, who can you trust? It's sad.
Which is no one, by the way. It's nobody. You can't trust anyone. So there's that.
Like I said, though, in book club, to try to like bring some levity, I guess. Levity, is that the word I'm looking for? Mm-hmm. Brevity? Levity.
Levity. Yeah, I've had brevity too much. Is short.
Yes,
levity
I've is had like too much
some humor.
Well, yes. To bring some levity to the situation. I do think, like, aside from just, you know, paying people a living wage to like do these kinds of jobs, because I think there are people out there who would want to do them and are capable of doing them. I think, yeah, we talked about like different situations in place, like where, and I don't know, like I haven't looked into these like recently, so I don't know if these like social programs still exist, but I do remember when I was in college, like reading about the Netherlands and,
yes, we did talk about this.
Yeah,
yes.
The co-living situation between like dorms and senior living. So it was like college students living with people who were living in like assisted living. And I feel like situations like that are just, it could be so beneficial like both ways, because both parties are getting something out of it. I think you're getting like that intergenerational connection that a lot of people take for granted. I think there are a lot of young people out there who don't necessarily have those family members. Like, mm-hmm. I think back to like my college experience, like how many international students there were who didn't have any family like living like in the same yeah. country as them. Like, and there is like the loneliness and like that you only get from like this kind of like family dynamic. And I think that that's just such a cool idea, because the young people are benefiting, getting the wisdom and like that family love from like an older person. And the older person obviously is benefiting from having a young person care for them who isn't just like, you know, trying to take advantage of them. And it isn't like necessarily Absolutely. Their like 9-to-5 job that they're getting paid like minimum wage or whatever to do, you know?
And not to keep talking about my family like they're some kind of saints or anything, but my sister, I remember, like, my whole life, she would visit nursing homes. Mm-hmm. And, like, that was her – she the care that she could give to people, like, I would feel uncomfortable, like, around strangers. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And she, she just has no discomfort around strangers. She's just like, everybody's great. And of a certain age, she doesn't really care for people who are younger than her, but people who are older than her, she is into. But so she would go to nursing homes and she would, like, take her dog and, like, just go around and see people and be like, what a great thing. And there are so many people in the world who could do that same thing.
Right.
And so if they were, like, had a place to live and they were working their way through college or whatever, you know, and like you pointed out, I just think there are so many personalities where that would be a great mashup of people. And there's these people, these young people who are capable of interacting with and caring for and enjoying the company of people who are older. And then those people, and that's good for older people too, because it's like they say, like, my grandparents spend so much time with their great grandchildren and they say that that, like, helps prolong their life because, you know,
it's the grandma. So, it goes back to the grandma theory.
It does go back to the grandma theory. And thank you for knowing more about that. Cause I was like, I heard about this one time and you're like, I'm an anthropologist. I know how that actually works.
For all we know, we've, like, talked about it on a previous, like, podcast episode, and we've just forgotten. Because I feel like I break it up, like, all the time to people, and they're just, like, staring at me like, what the fuck?
And I'm like, I know what it is, barely. Like, I learned about it one time.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, and I also think there's something to be said for, like, taking care of people who aren't necessarily, like, family, which I and that can sound weird, but, like, I think, like you're saying, like, there can be this level of discomfort, like, with strangers, but I think there's also a level of discomfort with family members sometimes because of the exact things, like, described in this book. Like, your view, like, your relative is no longer, like, how you knew them, like, growing up. And so that grandparent or whatever, however, like, you viewed them, like, they're no longer that person. They're someone else. But whoever is working in that facility, in that nursing home or wherever, like, that's not a different person to them.
Right.
Because that's the only version of that person that they know. And so I feel like sometimes they can be more accepting of that because of
that. It's more fair.
Yeah, it's almost easier for them to kind of accept that because there isn't, like, this weird kind of connection where it's, like, an expectations. I think expectations, like, plays, like, the biggest part, and they don't place any expectations on that person. Like, they're seeing them as a human instead of seeing them as a parent or caregiver or whatever.
Absolutely. And that's, like, from a personal standpoint, like, I think I put expectations on my dad, especially, which is really, I try not to. And anymore, I'm like, okay, you got to stop doing that. But, like, my mom, like, at my wedding, my father and I danced to the song, which, because we went into a whole lot of social norms, but we did the father-daughter dance to The Wonder of You. My mom was like, that's what you have to dance to, because for some reason you think he's, like, this great human being. And the rest of us are like, we don't understand, like, why you put him on this pedestal. But I did. Like, my dad was this person to me that I just can't imagine a better person. But the more I grow up and the more that we interact as adults, we have such drastic, like, he's on one side of the spectrum, like, politically and socially, and I'm on the other, and it's hard to acknowledge or to be okay with the fact that he's not what I mean, he is. He's still the greatest human person. I will never accept the fact that he's not the best dad in the world. But there is, like, socially, we disagree on a lot of things, and I didn't expect that. As an adult. And so I think that there are people out there better equipped to be like, when he ages and when we, you know, get to that stage, that there are people that are probably better than me to take care of him, you know, because they don't have that expectation that he's this, you know, infallible father figure.
Right.
And he was that for a lot of people who were not his children as well, which is...
Yeah.
You'd like this enormous thing to live up to as an actual mortal human person. Like, you know, And so I think that's unfair to put on him all of these expectations that, you know, you will be this, you know, pedestal
mm-hmm.
father that everybody is like, that's the father that everybody wants. And that's unfair to him. So he should be able to age and like live his life without me being like, you should be this instead. Like,
right.
I don't know. I just think that this book kind of prepares you for those things and tells you how to moderate yourself and to make sure that everyone has realistic expectations of the people, you know, their parents and of course yourself.
Yeah.
In these situations. So I don't know. I think it was definitely worth reading, and I hope there are more books out there for people who will have to deal with the fact that they have to take care of their parents in a as they age.
Yeah. Yeah.
And especially in America where we have to figure out how the fuck to pay for
and
how
to
how to deal with, you know, because they talked about that too, like
how much her mother like saved. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that
the
was
the pension
big,
and all yeah. that. Oh my God.
They talk about like how and that was sort of like an area of like resentment sort of for the author, like growing up. Like she understood it like once she became an adult, of course, but like growing up, like especially in an immigrant family, an immigrant household, like she was going to school and like seeing kids like wearing like name brand clothing and like her, she was like, I don't understand. Like my mom's a doctor. Like this doesn't make any sense. Like everyone knows like we make money, but yet like we live like we're poor. And she, you know, learns later on in life that it was because her, you know, mother was saving everything to make sure that she would never have be a burden like on her children and she would be able to pay for like
yeah.
the exorbitant cost of like
yeah
end of life care because it is like crazy expensive like these facilities it's nuts, it's
so much more it's like the amount it is every month like I can't fathom paying and I just hope that like nobody in my family on my side of the family tree has dementia or Alzheimer's. That's not a thing that runs in our family, but in Patrick's side, that is a thing that runs in the family. But I'm like, I hope that I can take care of Patrick. And then our child is just like, mom's old and feeble, but her brain is still like working. And I can just live in the same place because we
it won't be very different from your day-to-day life currently.
That is my hope. Like,
Child just wheels you to the bookshelf as you grab a book.
I'm going to read this today. Yeah. Don't even buy. Could you pour me a glass of wine? That'd be great.
Yeah, that's all you need.
But ultimately, yeah, because like we bought this place in Chicago with the fact that like we bought it. We're like, it's great. It's the right size for having children, whatever. And when we're 60, it'll be paid off.
Yeah.
And we only have to pay taxes moving forward. No mortgage.
Yeah.
And that thought is that we'll stay here forever and then our children won't have to like worry about paying for where we're going to live. But then it's like, okay, but the nurse that would have to like come in to take care of us would be like, it's so exorbitant.
Yeah.
And I don't know. In America, we just don't have those same, I don't know, those. It's impossible to take care of people and you're just going to be in debt forever.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's like my mom talks about, like, she's lucky because my grandparents dealt with their money very well. And so she can take care of them, except for that my grandma won't let any of the, she won't let the house cleaner or the nurse or the occupational therapist or the physical therapist or anyone come in because she's like, they're strangers. And like, my mom is like, seriously, could you just let them come in and work with my father? That would be great.
Wow.
But yeah, it's this that hyper independence of an American person. But
right.
Yeah. But anyway, this book was very helpful to read, to understand, to not make you feel guilty about the fact that society doesn't, or your education, your life doesn't prepare you for taking care of your parent once they're past the point of being your parent and being an elderly person. And it was a nice read. And it was – and I appreciated Amanda in our book club. Amanda, she's wonderful, but she had to take care of her grandparents as well. And she gave some really great insight to what that's like to take care of someone. Yeah. So it was very worth reading. And I hope there are more books like this that come out and help us with aging in place and all of that.
Agreed. All right, final book, Outlawed by Anna North. So I'm throwing this in to Women's History Month. Bit of a stretch, but it's fine. Because this is kind of considered to be contemporary feminist literature, so we're just lumping it in with Women's History Month. Summary. So, the day of her wedding in 1894, 17-year-old Ada's life looks good. She loves her husband, and she loves working as an apprentice to her mother.
I'm sorry. I have to interrupt right away. Yes. She's 17? I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, she's 17.
Okay.
I didn't either. I don't remember. I don't remember that, but apparently she was 17. I mean, it's 1894, so, you know.
Yeah. That makes sense, but still. All right.
So she's working as an apprentice to her mother, who's a respected midwife in town, delivering all the babies. But after a year of marriage and no pregnancy, during a time which barren women are routinely hanged as witches, her survival depends on leaving behind everything she knows. So she joins up with this notorious hole-in-the-wall gang, which is a band of outlaws that's led by this preacher turned robber known to all in the group as the Kid. And so the Kid is this charismatic, grandiose figure who's determined to create a safe haven for outcast women. But to make this dream a reality, the gang hatches this treacherous plan that could get them all killed. And Ada has to decide whether or not she's willing to risk her life for the possibility of a new kind of future for them all. So this was an interesting and hard to describe read. I think I'll start off with this review on Goodreads. From Miranda Benson, I think she summarized my main complaint about this book well. Ida is boring. She's a very inactive character. And when she does actively make choices, there's little to no expressed emotion and no explanation. The rest of the gang Ada joins is marginally better because they're at least more excited about being in an outlaw gang. But they're hardly fleshed out, so I kept confusing them with one another. That's pretty much how I felt.
Thank you, Miranda.
Yeah.
Right,
Miranda? Yes, Miranda. Thank you. Miranda Benson. Shout out to you on Goodreads. Yeah, I mean, I think like beyond like Ava's like mission to discover the cause of infertility, there's really not much to her character. Nor like the plot and her motivation. Like, what is her motivation really?
And that's like way into like
that's just like the literal like yeah. It's
the
so
majority
weird.
Of the book. That's not even a thing. It's later,
right?
At a whole.
Well, and it's also it's weird that like that's the main focus and like what is supposed to be like this like feminist book because. Instead of focusing on why do people give a shit so much about, like, women being barren, instead she focuses on the science behind it and, like, why are women barren? So it's, like, it's not arguing against, like, this whole weird, like...
Misogynistic. Is that the word I want? Misogynistic idea of why being barren is a problem.
Right, like your humanity is like you're worthless unless like you're producing children, basically. Like that's the only value placed on women. Like we're not questioning that. We just want to find out why we're barren.
And we don't even want to find that out all that much because ultimately we just want to live. I can't. I have no under. Okay. So Allie and I, I feel like, had the same problem. This book is really hard to get through.
Yeah, and it's so really short. Hard. Like, and it shouldn't be that hard to get through. I mean, it was like less than 300 pages, but yet it felt like it just was dragging on
forever. It dragged. And okay, so my notes. Okay, so my notes are that it's a Western Handmaid's Tale, where it's like all these women are supposed to just have babies and be fine.
Right.
The relationships, none of the marriages are described in any way where the two people loving each other is important at all. It's all about whether or not they have children in their relationship. And that was frustrating because this author and like the whole point of this book is for them to be outside of the feminine normative behaviors.
Right. Like instead of like Handmaid's Tale is like dystopian, whereas like this is supposed to be like alternate history. Mm-hmm. Although it seems like fairly accurate to just like normal, regular old history of what it's probably was like in late 1800s for women. I mean, so it's just like at that point, it's just like historical fiction, I guess, where it's like we're just telling the story that, you know, didn't really happen. It's not really so much alternate history. Like it's
no, it was like the Crucible only. Instead of witchcraft, it's we, except for that it is on some level witchcraft,
mm-hmm.
because we are going to eliminate you as a person because you can't have children.
Well, yeah, and they were, like, using witchcraft as the reason for killing these women. Like, if, and in many cases, like, they were, it wasn't just that the woman was barren, it was that other women in the community were having miscarriages, and then that was getting blamed on the barren woman. So all of a sudden she's a witch who's causing like everyone else's children to die. So, you know, burn her at the stake. I can't.
Yeah. Throw her up there, light her on fire. It's fine. And then I got a Faustus vibe. And again, I'm going to try to read my notes while I'm drunk. So we're going to see. How this is gonna go.
Getting sloppier toward the end.
It's fine. I got a whole Faustus vibe with the obtainable knowledge and the furthering of science as witchcraft / anti-religious, etc. Mm-hmm. So a conflict of values, power equals destruction, damnation. So ultimately, I think, in my drunken state, is what I was trying to get at with those notes is that we have women who are intelligent and who are understanding of what causes barrenness and all of that. Those women are seen as, because they're trying to be God, because they have, like the main character, Ava is her name?
Ada.
Ada.
Yeah.
You read it. I read it a long time ago. Anyway, Ada, her mother and her intelligence and all of that is considered to be is eventually taken into a negative light and a mm-hmm. Faustus kind of thing where the more knowledge you try to obtain, the worse you are as a person and all that. Right. It's because they're trying to understand what causes the barrenness and all of that kind of stuff. But I had a hard time because it was like too many characters.
Yeah.
So they didn't focus enough on one character for me to be invested in what was happening. I really wanted to care about who's the kid? The kid.
Yeah, I don't know if they had a name other than the kid.
Okay. Cause there was like a mental health issue.
Yeah.
And the fact they're barren. And then who was the guy who robbed the bank?
Oh, and like had Ada's lover?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember their name, but yeah, there's a character who I thought they were going somewhere different with that. I really did. I was like, I thought that was going to be like some kind of like trans like representation, and then it just turned into a man who had, you know, basically been. Like, had his sexual organs removed.
Yeah.
As punishment for... Oh, I guess he was gay, though, wasn't... Yeah, okay, so...
No, because Ada is a woman. He wasn't gay.
But he was bisexual. Like, yeah, but I think there's whenever he tells the story, so he lies to her initially and says it was like a woman that he was in love with, but it was actually a man.
Oh shit, you're right. You're right.
So he had gotten like chased out of town basically for being in love with a man, and then they, you know, basically
he's bisexual.
It was like a reverse castration. It like wasn't.
That's right.
Not to get into like gritty details here, but use your imagination, folks. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes. Yeah. So it was, I appreciated what this author was trying to do, which was encompass all of these like outside of the normative behaviors and the cisgender.
Right.
You know, I thought that it was great that they tried to do that. But the gang, there's so much that's happening. There's so many characters. You can't get involved and you can't care about any of them because there's too many. And it's this overwhelming story. And so you can't get involved or care enough to be invested in their stories.
Right.
And it's all very shallow.
Yeah, and I think I might be confusing this book with another book because when I like initially read like the synopsis, I swear that like for some reason, and I guess people let me know if there's like another book out there like this, I was imagining this like Western with lesbian librarians. Is that an actual book? Like, or am I just, like, making that up? Like, I think there is a book that was, like, that a lot of people were talking about fairly recently that is about the same length as Outlawed. Oh, my gosh. That's going to bother me. Their hat, like...
I'm sure it exists.
Or was this just, like, my expectation of what this should have been?
It might have been your expectation, honestly.
Because that would have been more interesting. Upright Women Wanted. So have you read that?
No, I have not read that.
Okay, I have not read it either. It's about the same length. Like, it's a short, and again, it's like a Western, but I think it's more set either, yeah, so this one's more dystopian. So I think this one's set in the future, but it's a band of, like, lesbian librarians. And I've also heard mixed things about that book because I think it gets people with like the subject matter. You're like, ooh, that's interesting and cool. And then people read it and were kind of disappointed. And I think I was getting them mixed up in my mind because I went into this thinking like there was going to be more about books. And like really it was just kind of like they do sell like medical books or like trade them with this chemist.
Right.
But that was about the extent of it. Like there's this like traveling like salesman who's I don't know sells books, but like I don't know, in my mind I was just like, where are the lesbian librarians?
Where are they? Yeah.
And so it was kind of disappointing. And even like the relationships like between the women like in this gang like weren't very interesting.
No. And even when she tried,
yeah,
like with the gang leader and like all of the relationships.
Yeah, the kid throughout. And like the kid kind of like has like a girlfriend partner, like we're not really sure what's going on there because they never say, like they never even really make anything of it except for like her partner being like, yeah, I owe my life to her, and that's pretty much it. Like it's so vague.
Right.
It's like I'm just indebted to her forever. It's like, okay, are you guys, like, are you together or, like, you just feel some kind of obligation, like, toward this person? Like,
right.
All right. So I think that's it for us today. We will see you all next time. Until then, cheers.
Cheers. Bye, guys.
Bye. stick around and subscribe to our podcast on whatever platform you're currently using to listen to us so that you'll receive updates whenever we upload a new episode. And be sure to follow us on Instagram at Novels with Nightcaps, where you can find links to our book club, website, and more. Until next time, happy reading. Cheers!